This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Here we are. We're going to solve the case as we always do every Friday. on the Nancy Guthrie investigation. Nancy Guthrie is 84 years old. She has no known cryptocurrency holdings. She lives in the Catalina foothills, one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in Tucson, and a $2 billion cybersecurity company just classified her alleged abduction as a wrench attack by proxy, a crime built around crypto extortion. So here's a question that nobody's been asking out loud yet, and I want to ask it today. What if whoever showed up at Nancy Guthrie's door that night was at the wrong house? And it's a wrench attack. And this is a mope. And once they were there, once an 84-year-old woman had seen them, they had a problem they couldn't walk away from. If that's what's happened, this isn't a case that the public thinks it is, and the real target may still be living in the neighborhood. Again, it's coming from the ethers of my brain. It's not coming from any verifiable information, but since we're hitting dead ends everywhere, I wanted to throw it out there. And joining us to have this conversation, Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. So there you go. That's my layperson idea that came to my mind when I was like, what if it just was the wrong house? It would kind of lean into the wrench attack and a mope and somebody that's not super experienced in this and goes to the wrong house. Is it a crazy idea, Jen?
You know, look, everything has to be on the table at this point with what we have, but I don't think that that's probably very likely, and this is why. Part of the reason is I really believe this was well planned out, even in terms of the fact that they did those ransom demands the day after. Mm-hmm. I don't think that was just something like, whoa, I think now I'll do a ransom demand. I think it was well thought out. They knew the two Tucson stations they were going to send that to, which happened very quickly. 12 hours later, TMZ. I think this was just too well planned. And Savannah and her husband are worth over $45 million. It's the perfect target.
I agree. Let me ask you this about the ransom, because if we're connecting the ransom, and I've been always so probably too cautious on connecting the dots of the ransom to the actual crime itself. I've immediately been thinking this is all, you know, people, opportunists trying to get money. How do we know this? And maybe Robin could run a stat on this. When someone is kidnapped, how quickly, especially like in a higher profile, how quickly do those ransom demands start coming in? And how quickly do the fake ransom demands start coming in? Is this a relatively short period of time for the initial ransom demands to be an opportunist? Is it just too quick for someone to go, I'm going to take advantage of that?
Well, I can't wait to see what Robin comes up with, but
I've
I think
this one before
going to be within 3 days.
Yeah.
That's my kind of recollection without stats in front of me, 3 days that a ransom demand, and obviously some are sooner. And remember, it also depends on who took them. Are we talking
24 hours?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
For legitimate ones?
60 to 75% within 24 hours, 48 hours, 85 to 90%. So everything within 48 hours for legit ones.
And if 12 hours is where they hit at, put some weight on them.
Yeah. So it's within legit. I'll do a reverse now.
Sure.
It's within the legit. And I would say, too, that the majority of those demands are gangbangers, drug dealers, people demand right away. Because that's the majority of ransom demands that come in. That's just.
Within 24 hours for fake ones as well.
Interesting. Robin, what's your take on this idea, this theory that I have before we go to the next question? Because I'm curious to get your thoughts on me throwing that one out into the table.
So I like the idea that we're throwing another idea out there, definitely. Only because every single theory we have makes sense at the get-go, and then it falls off because it doesn't quite fit what we've seen from the background of Nancy, Savannah. I know we can, you know, make it kind of fit with a lot of things, but it's still, if you're looking at averages, it just keeps falling off. Now, mm-hmm. if they completely got it wrong, because here's where I like about it. I like it for the wrench attack where they hired the Mope, because the Mope, you know, he was fluid on that front step, like he was there before-ish. But at the same time, though, you know, I'm then riffing off of what Janet said before about taking the weeds and the branches mm-hmm. and crap with a nest can. In other words, he seemed prepared for everything except that. That kind of lends to the fact that he wasn't ready for that house's front steps. I don't know. I like the idea of let's explore that a bit more. So the first thing that I thought of, Tony, when you said it, is like, all right, let's look at the background and people that surround her that are very close proximity. Does any one of those have any known crypto? What's their net worth? So I'd actually be looking a little bit more at that. And also, so here's what you, I don't know if they're doing this. They should have been doing this if they're not. I'd also then be doing at least one degree of separation from all her neighbors as well, because that's one way you can flush this out. Is like, all right, so let's look at all their gardeners, let's look at all their mm-hmm. pool people, let's look at all these other people, one degree of separation, because if you got no more leads here, we can just expand that concentric circle out to the surrounding homes and see if any of that fits.
I guess my question would be, what kind of investigative reach do they have to take a look at neighbors, if they have crypto or if they have something like this where it would fit the wrench attack theory, but the person went to the damn wrong house. And I'm sorry, anybody in that neighborhood. I'm in no way in trying to insinuate that you had anything to do with this whatsoever. I'm just trying to think about, was someone else the intended target here? And if they were, that might be a little concerning too. if the someone else was taken and you were the intended target originally, that means they're still out there and so are you. So that would be a bit of a concern, I think, to anybody in the neighborhood if they went to the wrong person.
I don't think it'd be too hard to do it because, you know, all the neighbors have been pretty compliant. You just do a very structured interview of the information you're trying to flush out during that. What do you think, Jen?
Well, I agree with that. And I agree that they know whether Savannah has crypto or not.
Mm-hmm.
They knew that on, you know, day two. Somehow Certicay thinks they have it.
That's where I get good to Certicay.
Yep.
Where, what do we know? Do we know anything more about the Certicay and their report that they release that lists Nancy in there as being a wrench attack more than we did last week, Jen? Have you found anything else out about how they got to that conclusion?
No, not anything more, but just I find it very interesting their nexus with other FBI investigations and the fact that they are able to really dial down on blockchains. And mm-hmm. in other words, blockchains that connect to other wallets that are suspicious. That's what they do. You know, it's really interesting. It's like a white collar crime squad. What does a white collar crime squad do? It analyzes different information it has regarding transactions that mm-hmm. call the attention different offices, right? And then that comes into the Bureau. So that's how I see Certicay too, is actually giving information to the Bureau. We know they do on different crypto security issues.
So had this kidnapping gone right, what would we have been looking at differently? What would have happened next that didn't happen here?
Oh, I love that question. I mean, what we're looking at is the fact that they could have given some sort of proof of life. And actually, maybe the Guthries would have paid. But I will caution that a lot of these ransoms are paid without proof of life. And they are paid, for instance, there's other ransoms that involve Bitcoin that don't have to do with life, but rather have to do storative information, right? Information that other that they've got that companies want back, that they extort money from them, right?
So then what kept it from happening then? So if a lot of these things don't require a sign of life and Nancy had the money, and they even said that they were willing to just retrieve her body, what kept everyone then from pulling the trigger if everyone thought this was legit?
You know what I think? I truly believe that the FBI would have said, don't do it without proof of life. And even though they always say it's a suggestion, we suggest this. This is what we've seen. We don't want to feed kidnappers and we don't want to do that. And you don't have proof of life, blah, blah, blah. What are most people going to do? They are going to follow the direction. I can't think of one time we made a suggestion to a civilian about what they should or shouldn't do. And they didn't say, forget that. Sure. I'm going to do what I want. So I think that's why it wasn't done.
But what about now?
Well, now she's obviously, well, not obviously. It's a big possibility that she's gone. They still have those numbers, but has communication been lost other than that Bitcoin wallet? I don't think they're willing to risk it. I've always said, tickle the wire, send a significant amount, whether that's 100, 200,000, throw out some bait here. No one will do it. If they have done it, we don't know about it. And we would, because TMZ has the Bitcoin wallet number.
Do you think I'm all about just poking it, you know, and, you know, to get a stick and just poke the bear, see what it does. You know, what would it take? I don't think it would take much for someone to say, either Nancy or law enforcement, someone say, hey, all right, we've given up. We're ready to just pay some money. You know, is this good? I mean, if they've communicated through TMZ before, why not keep going? I mean, do you think that these people have given up on this and moved on? Or, I mean, just it's the lack of continued action on their part, which makes every element of this a little skeptical to me, because if they wanted money so bad and they went through this effort, get it. Just do something to get it then. Or do they just typically move on?
Well, have they stopped? I keep saying there is no facts that those other six messages, approximately six messages that TMZ got. And if you listen to TMZ, they think that they're related. That's what they think it's related. Look, it's the exact same modus operandi, right? Nobody else is going in there because they know they can do it without getting caught, at least so far.
What I was surprised by early on was these messages going to the air. I mean, I know they didn't read them verbatim, but they were like, we got these messages. And the fact that, and there could have been two paths of how that got that way. Number one, they got the messages and they went to the air. Nothing in between. Like, we're going to get this. Of course, you know, we're going to let the FBI know, but we're going to get this out before they tell us not to. But they did it several times over. What I'm surprised by in that sort of a situation is, do you think the FBI advised TMZ or anything and said, look, if you get more, don't talk about it? Just, you know, because this happens in media organizations. Authorities do sometimes contact the organization that's reporting and saying, look, we know this is a back and forth with you. Shut up. Our goal here is to find this person. And in a case like this, I would think most entities would be like, I hear you. Okay, whatever I can do to help you in this thing. It's not, you know, obstructing the investigation, and you have to have your journalistic ethics here of, do I report this, do I not? I would think most would say, okay, let's not report this, unless the FBI's thought was, this helps the case by putting this out there. I don't know. I'm do you think the FBI said when these letters came in, stop reporting about it? I know some of the TV stations didn't run with letters they got.
I think the FBI would have said, don't report this. Don't say anything.
They thought to say that? I'm wondering, like, if there was, like, not the right oversight there of, like, tell them to stop doing this.
Well, we saw in action the two initial statements, the local stations didn't say anything. Mm-hmm. And I think that's in large part why TMZ was reached out to by this same group 12 hours later.
Okay.
You know, they sent these letters, and that to me, and Robin, I really want to hear your take on this, because that to me shows a level of wanting to really hurt the Guthrie family, embarrass the Guthrie family, have this out there that it's not paid. And are they sophisticated enough to know the Bureau would say this? And so this is humiliation, or are they using this as a pressure. Look, it's out there. Millions and millions. Everybody's seeing this. So it's time to pay.
Yeah. So it makes sense if the local stations weren't responding to their initial reach out, and then they escalated to national level. So I'm more on the crypto wrench side of these things than any retribution against Savannah or Nancy, only because of the lack of leakage prior and after. You know, if it's going to be anything, it's because, again, they're going for something in that house, and it just doesn't really fit behavior for retribution for me in any way. Yeah. But again, everything can fall off. But it makes sense that they would then escalate to TMZ, even though the probability of them doing this methodology and not going straight to the family is not the way it typically goes either. Because proof of life, I looked up the stat again, just reiterating, we've done it all before, it's like 90, 95% of the time there's always a proof of life provided on the immediate ransom, which they couldn't do. We assume they couldn't do. Something went sideways.
Jen, if they were to suddenly take the Bitcoin wallet that is sitting there that no one has accessed, that has a couple hundred something sitting in it, what if they were to take that, put like $100,000 in it, and it were to be withdrawn? How quickly could they determine who withdrew that and where it went to and where that person was? If they were to try this little experiment out,
it 100%. Depends on how they withdrew it. Did it go to another wallet and then to another wallet and then to another wallet and then out? And how did it get out? Remember, it has to go out either to be converted to francs or US dollars or, you know, whatever the currency is. But it can't stay in Bitcoin. It could stay in Bitcoin because Home Depot takes it and various restaurants now and everything. But that kind of money, you're going to want to have it more liquid. So to your question, it can possibly be traced, but it could be difficult depending on how it is finally makes it into currency. There could be so many steps.
Sure.
But like I said before, currency is hard to trace too. Yeah. You don't not do something because it's going to be difficult. That's how I see.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm not saying that because it'd be difficult, but is it even possible, or is there a clear out that whoever is playing with the money knows a way that, oh, you think you're being smart here, let me transfer it to this wallet, let me break it down into 40 more wallets, let me break all that down into 40 more wallets, and then we'll just kind of distribute it this way and that way, and eventually it will come out. And I mean, it's a lot of following the money, probably to a point where you can't follow the money. I'm not super versed in how all that world works other than what I'm kind of learning here, but it's not as clear cut as it would be of just putting $100,000 in that wallet, from what I'm hearing, and then waiting for someone to get a wild hair and think they're going to outsmart the system. There's probably ways to still outsmart the system, even.
Yeah.
With
so here's what I looked up while we're chatting. So wrench attacks, hard to solve. 25 to 40% result in arrests only. But they can trace the lack of any arrests recovered funds so far in Nancy's case. And one reason why experts doubt it was some doubt it, but they can trace it to a certain extent, just like Jen was saying. But it's challenging. But again, 25 to 40% of the ones that are solved.
And Certitech, that's what they do.
Yeah.
Right. That's the Bureau would not be doing this. This is not some agent sitting there.
Oh, yeah, definitely not.
This is Certitech, which is what their experts do every day. They're subject matter experts.
So there's a reason they're saying this. We just don't know the exact reason yet. But it seems to be this. Would you call this the strongest lead that's come out of this case so far? Seeing, I mean, at least from a digestible point of those of us on the outside trying to figure this thing out, would this be the strongest thing that you've seen for a signal coming out of this case?
Well, yeah, you know, I definitely went to paper on that a while back. So I'm sort of stuck with it now, no matter how it comes out. But I mean, that is our strongest signal. That's without a doubt the strongest lead we in the public have, not being able to see the entirety of the case. Certitech is putting their reputation on the line. Could it be all just for some sort of, you know, publicity? Maybe, you know, I got to tell you, I am working on a couple of things in the background with that. More to come.
There's your tease. The tease. Now everyone sits on pins and needles waiting for what you discover. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of it. I'm sure we'll be talking about it next week. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube as we continue our conversation here.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Brewski. Here now, Tony Brewski.
There's a lot of theories out there about the Nancy Guthrie case, about what happened to Nancy. This week in a five-part series, we are going to go through five of them. I don't know if they're the most popular, the most talked about. I tried to find the ones that I thought were the most talked about at the moment of this recording. But the thing is, with theories like this, the biggest ones one week are not the biggest the next. They come and they go. So we're going to try and hit them all as best we can. And the thing with this is, I want your opinions. I want your thoughts. If there's a hole in my debunking, if you will, or the information I'm bringing that points against this theory being something we can consider, if there's just strong evidence to the point that says, and here's where this makes this impossible. But if you think there's a way that it's not, all ears, comment section, okay? This is not to tell you you're stupid or you're wrong or whatever. This is just, okay, it's easy to get down some of these rabbit holes and go, okay, this seems like we get that confirmation bias going, I get it. But it's also good to have, as Robin would tell us, a loving critic, someone who can go, wait a second, all right? So we're going to start here. Press subscribe so you don't miss them. We're doing one a day, every day this week. The Puerto Vallarta private jet. That theory. Where Nancy was kidnapped, put on a jet, and flown into Mexico. Here's kind of how it goes, and here's kind of what reality tells us about how much legs the story should actually have. Nancy Guthrie's pacemaker lost its Bluetooth connection at 2:28 in the morning on February 1st. At 4:45 that same morning, roughly 2 hours later, a small private jet took off from Tucson International Airport headed to Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. Oh my gosh. Look at the timing. That's an unusual early departure for a Sunday, right? If I tell you it is, you probably think it is, right? If I say that's weird, is it really, though? Or is it just because I'm saying it out loud and it making you think that it's weird? Like somehow I looked it up and said, oh, it's weird for a private jet to be leaving that time of the day on a Sunday. Is it really, though? Or is it just the power of my suggestion or whoever I heard it from and now I'm repeating that information? Anyway, within days, keep that in mind, within days, people all over the internet had connected those two data points into one of the most viral theories this case has produced. Nancy Guthrie was taken from her home and driven to the airport, loaded into that Cessna Citation Mustang, and flown to a cartel stronghold in Mexico. Some versions connected to sieging the Gisilo New Generation Cartel. In the territory where a drug lord, El Mencho, operated before his death. I understand why this one caught fire. When you lay out the timeline, it feels kind of real. Two events, same, just 2 hours apart. A woman who vanished. That's a clean narrative. It's a dramatic one, too. There's a reason it became one of the single most shared theories in the entire case. But clean narratives are only clean until someone checks whether the pieces actually fit, so we're going to check. It's a detail about the suspect on Nancy's doorbell camera that kind of kills the theory before we even get to the Mexico part, and we'll get there. And the pacemaker, the thing that supposedly anchors the whole timeline, a doctor went on record and explained what that Bluetooth disconnection actually means. It's not what the internet decided it was. First, let's be fair about why this theory exists, because it's not coming from nowhere. Tucson sits roughly 60 miles from the Mexican border. Southern Arizona is a known corridor for cross-border criminal activity. A anonymous emails sent to TMZ demanded Bitcoin, a payment method people associate with cartel operations or criminal operations. One of those emails claimed the sender saw Nancy south of the border in the Mexican state of Sonora. A private investigator named Bill Garcia went on the record with Border Report saying he believed the cartel was involved in a money-making venture. And the FBI formally contacted Mexican federal authorities about the case. If you're sitting at home connecting the dots, it doesn't feel crazy. It feels logical. The problem is that every one of those dots, examined on its own, falls apart. The private jet, the aircraft, was a 19-year-old Cessna Citation Mustang. Small, aging airplane. The FBI looked into this flight, they investigated it, and they moved on. No authority has ever linked it to Nancy's disappearance. Not one. And here's what the people sharing the theory have leave out. Private jets leave Tucson for Mexican resort destinations constantly. Puerto Vallarta is one of the most common routes. A plane departed on an airport, in a time window near an unrelated event. That's a coincidence. The internet decided it was a clue. Those are not the same things. Planes do leave the airport at odd hours. It's not a rarity. A pacemaker, and this is where the doctor matters. Nancy's pacemaker lost its Bluetooth sync to her phone at 2:28 a.m. A physician who spoke on the record to People magazine explained something the internet never bothered to learn. A pacemaker is not a GPS device. They're not the same. Just because your phone is GPS and Bluetooth and all that doesn't mean your pacemaker is. Those are different features. They are not the same thing. GPS and Bluetooth are different things. It connects to a phone via the short-range Bluetooth. If Nancy was moved away from her phone, even to a different room in the same house, the connection could drop. That's all the Bluetooth loss tells us. It tells us when Nancy and her phone were no longer close to each other. It does not tell us she was in a vehicle. It does not tell us she was on her way to an airport. It does not tell us she crossed any border. It doesn't tell us that she went into the sky on an airplane. It tells us her body and her phone were separated. End of story. That's it. The entire theory built on this timeline treats a short-range Bluetooth connection as though it were a satellite tracking event. And it wasn't. Here's where the theory really starts to unravel. The FBI contacted Mexican authorities. The internet treated that as confirmation that investigators believe Nancy had been taken across the border. And again, it wasn't. Retired FBI Supervisory Special Agent Jackson Pack explained on the record that when a disappearance occurs near the border, federal protocols activate automatically, regardless of whether there's evidence the person crossed. It's a procedural step, not a lead. You check the box because the box exists, not because the evidence points south. Sheriff Nano said publicly there was no evidence Nancy was taken to Mexico. I know I put very little weight on anything Nano says, but there you go. NBC News sources, two officials briefed on the case confirmed the same thing. The FBI reaching out to Mexico was a protocol. And the internet turned it into proof. Let's close the loop on the doorbell camera because this is the part that really should have ended the cartel theory the moment the footage was released. The suspect on Nancy's doorbell camera arrived at her home and discovered the camera was there. He wasn't expecting it. He improvised. He pulled weeds from the yard and used them to cover the lens. He didn't disable it with a tool. He didn't know the back end footage was recoverable from the system. The FBI's own characterization of this person, he doesn't appear to be very sophisticated. He does things a professional would not do. Think about what a cartel extraction actually requires. You're coordinating across international borders. You're moving a person through law enforcement checkpoints. You have networks, logistics, vehicles staged, and a destination secured. The people who do this for cartels are operatives with experience. They have done this before many times. They do not show up to a house, get surprised by a consumer doorbell camera, and grab a handful of weeds off the ground. That's not a cartel operative. That's someone who was not prepared for what he found when he got there. The DNA. Investigators recovered DNA from Nancy's property, ran it through CODIS, the FBI's National Criminal Defense Database, which holds over 22 million profiles. The result, no match. means the suspect has never been arrested, never been processed, never been in the system for anything. Not a traffic stop, not a prior offense, not a deportation, nothing. At least in the DNA that's been tested so far. Yes, there is that mixed up DNA. I know there's a more scientific word for it, but that's the best way I'm going to describe it right now, that they are still working on trying to identify. Cartel operatives who cross international borders, who move people and contraband through some of the most surveilled corridors in the Western Hemisphere, those people have records. They have been fingerprinted, probably. They've been deported and re-entered. They have encounters with law enforcement on both sides of the border. A completely clean code. Its profile doesn't really fit that world. It's structurally incompatible with organized cross-border crime. And every credible professional who's weighed in publicly agrees. Former FBI agent Matt Cavanaugh told NBC News he sees no reason a cartel would target someone like Nancy Guthrie. His read, this is more likely a homegrown criminal who panicked when the case exploded nationally. A retired Pima County lieutenant called the cartel involvement possible but far-fetched. News Nation's Brian Anton, the reporter who's covered this case more closely than almost anyone, reported that multiple law enforcement sources told him the case shows no signs of cartel involvement. Not one credible source with actual investigative knowledge has put evidence behind this theory. Every single one has pushed back. So what are we left with? Well, the cartel theory doesn't survive contact with really many verified facts. Not a jet, not the pacemaker, not the CODIS result, not the suspect's behavior on camera, not a single law enforcement source on record. It exists for two reasons. Tucson is near a border. The anonymous email sent to a celebrity news outlet mentioned Mexico. Those are the only data points. Everything else, the cartel connections, the El Mencho territory, the private jet extraction is interference stacked on assumption, built inside a vacuum that the internet filled with the most dramatic story it could construct. And those ransom emails, the ones that mention Mexico, we're going to be dedicating an entire episode to those later in the series. What I can tell you now, at least one person has already been arrested for sending a fake ransom in this case. And he had absolutely nothing to do with Nancy's disappearance. A cartel extraction by private jet is a thriller. It's cinematic. It gives people a villain they can identify and a narrative with clear stakes. The actual evidence points to something far less dramatic. An unprepared individual who improvised on scene, who didn't know the camera was there, who has never been in the criminal justice system. That's not a cartel operative. That's someone who may have never done anything like this before. And I know that's hard to sit with because it means the answer to this case might be smaller and uglier than the theory. What if it was the cartel? Well, they certainly didn't ask for their money then, did they? At least not the way the cartels do. Nancy Guthrie is still missing. The case has been reclassified as a homicide investigation. The reward stands at $1.2 million. If you know something real, not a theory built on a flight schedule and a Bluetooth disconnection, call the FBI at 1-800-CALL-FBI. Next, the internet's evidence factory. We're going to go into some of the biggest pieces of standalone evidence in this case, the ecosystems they've created, and we're going to talk about all of them. Again, your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'll continue our conversation there. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.
Normally in these ads, you expect somebody to ask you to buy something, but this is something different. I'm Julian Barnes, and I'm a reporter for The New York Times. I'm a national security reporter, and that means I'm reporting on military operations. These are fast-paced, quickly moving situations. What exactly is happening on the ground is often shrouded in mystery, but we turn to trusted sources, satellite imagery, and expertise built up over years in order to ferret out the facts that wouldn't otherwise come to light. I'm here to ask you to seek out a news source that does firsthand fact-based reporting. If it's your local paper, great. If it's the Times, thank you. Because where you go for your information matters.